So we are actually in what's called the interval between the second coming and the millennium, the millennial reign of Christ. So we're gonna, you can go ahead and turn to Revelation 19. We'll stay there because there's some parts in Revelation 19 we'll look at, and then into Revelation 20 that we'll look at. That's in what's called the interval, or the 75-day interval. You may not have ever studied this. You probably haven't. You probably never heard of that because it's such an obscure issue. But the fact remains, there are several major events that happen in what's called the 75-day interval that you've read about, but you just probably didn't know where the timing of it was particularly at. The 75-day interval is about tying up loose ends. And the theme I want to get out of this is tying up loose ends. Now, let me give you this statement, and you tell me how you react to this. When someone tells you, well, time will heal all things, what do you say to an individual that tells you, don't worry, time will heal all things? Slap them? No, okay, someone had a tough Christmas. have you heard someone tell you that? Well, time will heal all things. What?
Yeah,
that's one way of looking. Eventually we'd be dead in the dirt. That's one way of looking at it. Sure. But does time really heal all things?
No.
I hear people, especially at funerals, they'll say this, and they don't know what they're doing a lot of times because they don't know how to handle grief. They'll come to somebody that's lost somebody, and they'll pat them on the back. Don't worry, time will heal all things. And they've just lost somebody. And it's like, man, that's the wrong thing to say right now. To them. Or if they have someone in their family that's belligerent, that's acting like a knucklehead, well, give him some time or give her some time and she'll get straightened out eventually. She'll figure out she's wrong. Have you seen that mentality? A lot of times parents do that. And one sibling is telling mom and dad, hey, so-and-so's acting up, man. Why don't you guys get on to her or him or whatever? Well, just let time pass it, you know. And you end up having to see people, allow people to keep doing things the way they do. Let me ask you, does somebody that's acting like a knucklehead, just the passage of time, make them all better at the end of it?
No.
No, it doesn't. What really is the reality of things?
Usually
they get worse. The general trend, if you look at the Bible of humans, the trend is to get worse unless they're confronted in salvation with the gospel and they get saved. Or if they are a believer, the general trend is if they don't get right with the Lord, eventually discipline will start happening to their lives and things will start erupting in their life as the Lord tries to woo them back from the prodigal life living. And time sometimes doesn't do anything. It makes them continue to go into the situation they're in worse. They get worse off. So don't ever let anyone come to tell you, well, time will heal all things. Mm-mm. That's not the way you play the game. Time is used by God in different circumstances. A lot of times time is allowed to be used as hindsight. And you can look back and say, oh, I see that. Okay. What we're going to try to get out of this, because it's a very technical passage, block of information that we're going to look at. You're going to see a lot of things that don't even apply to you. A lot of things in the future that the Lord's going to do. But what you're going to see from this is the Lord's way of tying up loose ends in people's lives. In this case, it's in the world's history. He's tying up all the loose ends. He's finally going to deal with it in his timing and in the right way. Here's what I want you to notice in this. Look at how the Lord handles evil in tying up the loose ends of it. Look how tying up loose ends actually helps people. Here's one of the things most people don't realize. The more you let things keep going on and thinking in your mind, well, maybe they'll work themselves out of it, and not confront it and not deal with it, things will continue to unravel, and you'll have more tying up loose ends if you ever deal with it. So the longer you let something go, the worse it becomes a lot of times. You have to confront it quickly and in a speedy manner. In the way the Lord deals with it, that is how he's doing things. And because he's dealing with it, it blesses the right people. In families, a lot of times, when somebody's in the family, an agitator, a knucklehead, and they're somebody's allowing them to act this way, guess what? Everybody in the family suffers. Because they're watching this and they're thinking, do you realize how devastating this is to the family? Well, everyone's affected because somebody's behavior and it's not being confronted. Now I take it to the church family. When somebody in the church acts like a knucklehead, and you know you'll run into them eventually. You know it, and they're causing problems. I've had them cause problems in classes. They're knuckleheads in classes that agitate. They're there for ulterior reasons, and they're agitating. And I've seen classes totally break apart. The class didn't exist anymore because of one individual that kept agitating the group. So they all split. So when I talked to the teacher one time, I said, man, you should have cut that off 6 months ago, man. How come you kept allowing that to go? Well, we thought maybe he would work through it. Well, obviously, your class worked through it. They voted with their feet, and they're gone. So, what does it do? If you allow something to continue to go on, it starts affecting everybody. Because sin can't be contained. It's Pandora's box. So, when you watch this, as the Lord handles it, he handles it in an effective manner, which blesses people. Because he's confronting it and dealing with the issue. Okay, let's go through this. Turn to Revelation 19. Let's read a small passage about one of the issues that the Lord will deal with. Revelation 19, start in 20. Just real quick, just that one verse. This is one instance that will happen in the 75-day interval. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshiped the image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. And the rest were killed with a sword which proceeded in the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled on the with their flesh. So here's one instance that happens in the 75-day interval where the Antichrist and the false prophet are cast alive into the lake of fire. They're the first inhabitants into the lake of fire. Okay, I'm going to get back to that. Now keep moving with me. Chapter 20. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit, this is the abuso or the abyss, and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, obviously that's Satan, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he is cast into the bottomless pit and shut up, and set a seal on him, so that he should not deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. So there's a couple of instances of things that happen after the second coming, but prior to the 1,000-year reign of Christ. Christ will not start the kingdom until these loose ends are dealt with. The loose ends are the Antichrist, the false prophet, and Satan himself and his dominions. And you obviously see quickly what the Lord does with these three individuals. The satanic trinity is right here in this verse. He has dealt effectively with the satanic trinity. Okay, let me back up. You kind of get you where I'm going. This is the interval. But where does the 75 days come from? Okay, ready to do math? Okay, Daniel gives us the math, okay? This is on your outline, by the way, of all the events that happened in the 75-day interval. There's a lot of events that happen. So honestly, this is the end of the bowl judgment. Second coming is right here. Messianic kingdom. So all in this space is a 75-day interval. All this must happen. Here's what I'll say. I don't necessarily know the chronological order. No one does. Of this. All we know is it all happens during this period of time. It's all sandwiched in the 75 days. We can kind of guess on some events, but it's all there in this period of time. Okay. Daniel 12 says this, read this, and from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, The abomination of desolation is set up. There shall be 1,290 days. Whoa. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. In these two passages, Daniel has added days to the tribulation period. The tribulation period has two blocks of time, 1,260 days. But what does it say, 1,200 and what?
90.
Okay, so in that verse, he has added 30 more days to the end of the tribulation. You got that one? Okay, now, next verse, he adds several more. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. He's just added 45 more days to it. Altogether, you get your 75 days. It's there for everyone to see. So you're to do the math. Is Daniel expecting you to do the math? And what Daniel is trying to tell you is there are an extra 75 days after the second coming and before the millennium. So because this is the first one is tied to the abomination of desolation. We'll get to that. Okay. The tribulation is made up of two sections. I talked to you about that. 42 months or 3.5 years equaling 200 altogether, 2,520 days or 7 lunar years from the tribulation. So anytime you see years in the Bible, it's, especially in the book of Revelation, it's lunar, 360 days, not 365. Daniel indicates 1,290 days from the abomination of desolation to the removal of the abomination of desolation. This is an extra 30 days. So here's what I want you to think about. Jesus comes back, kills everybody, kills the Antichrist, kills the false prophet, destroys his armies, frees the captives of Jerusalem, but he lets stand the abomination of desolation in the temple for an extra 30 more days. I wonder why. Why didn't he just destroy it immediately? He lets the abomination stand for 30 more days while he's present. Daniel also indicates that believers, Jews and Gentiles, who lived in the end of the 1,335 days will be blessed. This is extra 45 days beyond the 1,290 days. Has to do with the judgment. Okay? This is all, it all works together. You'll see. Let's get to 75 days. Okay. First thing is the removal of the abomination of desolation. Daniel talks about the abomination. Chapter 12 talks about it. And Matthew 24 talks about it as well. But it's this passage right here that talks about the abomination of desolation standing in the temple for 30 extra days. Okay, let's talk about this. What is, first of all, the abomination of desolation? It's two things in one. It's, first of all, the Antichrist going into the temple declaring himself to be God. That's the first phase. Second phase is when he actually puts in an image of himself that seems to have life inside the Jewish temple. Okay? So, effectively, the removal of the abomination is twofold. First, must eliminate the Antichrist, and second, then must eliminate the statue or the idol erected to the Antichrist. Well, we've already seen last week what Christ did with the Antichrist. He killed him. He destroyed him. His body is on the ground, and his army tramples on his body, and there is no burial given to the Antichrist. Last week, you saw immediately as his soul goes into Hades, the inhabitants of Hades are in a frenzy saying, "You have become weak just like us. You're no more powerful than anyone in Hades right now, so you're just like us." He kills them. That kills the first phase of the abomination. Second phase is the dismantling of the tribulation temple and the abomination, which he will do in that 30 days. Again, I want you to hold this question in your mind. Why keep it for 30 more days when he could just go in there and take it out? Hold on to that thought. Antichrist is cast alive in the lake of fire. Wait a second, Brandon. You just read that passage in Revelation. He was cast alive. But then I showed you last week, Christ kills him. By the breath of his mouth, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 says he destroys the Antichrist. Wait a second. Is there a contradiction? How could he kill him but then be cast alive into the lake of fire? Ah, yes, very good. He resurrects him. That quickly? Yep. So in the 75-day interval, Antichrist has been killed. Christ apparently resurrects him, and then in his unglorified body that he will have, he casts him into the lake of fire, alive. You're never really truly dead. No one really, really ceases to exist. You obviously know that. Whether you die an unregenerate or a regenerate, the unregenerates are alive in Hades right now. They're conscious and fully aware. But the fact is, he actually resurrects them. You think, I've never heard of that. I thought only believers got resurrected. Mm-mm. The scripture over and over teaches that not only the righteous be resurrected, but the unrighteous will be resurrected or raised from the dead. Daniel 12 talks about this. Isaiah 26 talks about this. Several passages in Matthew talk about it. But what's the difference? What's the difference between a righteous person being resurrected and an unrighteous person being resurrected? Any difference? You better believe there's a big difference. The righteous person is glorified. They will shine like the stars. You will be illuminated. You will not sin. You will not be able to perpetrate evil anymore. Ah, but wait. The unrighteous are given a body. We don't have any details about this body that they get. But this body allows them to suffer in hell, feel the fire without being consumed, and allows them to live in that state in a body and soul unit for all of eternity. They are not glorified. Those don't get. And here's the thing. There is no mention that their sin nature is removed from them. When we have a glorified body, the promise is, who will rescue me from this body of death? Christ will, because we're going to be glorified. We will not have the sin nature.
You said earlier they will be as the ones that are already there. They're no different. So this is an ultimate humiliation to the Antichrist to be brought down to the same level as the...
It's absolutely the ultimate humiliation. You're at the level of the commoner in hell. You're nothing more than a worm. Everybody in hell is at the same level. Yes, there's degrees of torment, but as far as there is no person in hell beaming with pride about themselves. They are destroyed. The idea of being in hell, the term in the Greek is ruination, and the concept you want to keep in mind is that if you had a light bulb and I dropped that light bulb and it went on the ground, it shatters, correct? And if I asked you, does the light bulb still exist? You would say yes, but it's in a shattered state. It's a ruination. That is what is described in the Greek as far as people being in hell. They are in a ruination state. They're ruined, but they continue to exist. This body will feel the effects of flames, but it will not be consumed. I don't know how that happens, but God allows that to happen. The flames of hell are real. You see it, the lake of fire. It's Gehenna. The lake of fire that's what it is. A lake of fire burning with brimstone and things. I guess our common analogy would be lava. They're in a lava lake, continually burning for all eternity. So the first two inhabitants of this location, because no one's in there right now. Everyone's in hell. Everyone's in Hades right now. But the first two inhabitants are the Antichrist and the false prophet thrown alive into there. So we see that happening. False prophets cast alive into it as well. Okay, so that's assumed. So this is the false Holy Spirit, the satanic trinity being there. Now we have the confinement of Satan to the fourth abode, or the abuso. You read that, Revelation 1 through 2. I saw a great angel come with a chain. What's the idea? It's the confinement of Satan to the fourth abode. Every time Satan the first time he fell, he left the abode of the covering cherub on God's throne. He was the canopy cherub over God's throne. So now he's removed from that abode. His abode then was the atmospheric heavens. He lost access to that. He had access to heaven as well, but he's thrown out of heaven eventually in Revelation 12. He's cast out of that abode, and only confined to the earthly abode on the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. So as you're watching, I want you to see, he noticed his confinement gets smaller, smaller, and smaller, to where at this point he is captured. Christ has a very powerful angel take him and put him in the abuso, or the pit, for 1,000 years. All this to say, also, his demons are there as well. They're not allowed to roam free anymore. They are now all in the pit for the millennial reign of Christ. What does that tell you about the conditions of the reign of Christ when he reigns here? If there is no Satan and no demons,
there's
no deceivers anymore, right? There's no outside temptation.
No enemy.
Yeah, there's no enemy as far as that we have to worry about even right now, because we know that Satan prowls around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. That doesn't exist in the millennium. He is taken away. There is no undercurrent happening. There's no God of this world. The God of the universe is sitting now on David's throne, and he will not allow Satan to roam free. We will look at this when we get to it. Satan is released at the end of the millennium. And what does he do? He deceives the nations once again and causes another revolt against Jesus. An outright revolt at the end of the millennium. We'll look at that when we get to the millennium next week. Can you imagine? I want you to think about this. Can you imagine? I mean, right now, we're in the invisible kingdom. It's called the mystery kingdom. People shake their fist to God right now, but they don't see him. It's invisible. But in the kingdom, Christ will be visibly present in Jerusalem, and a generation will say, we will not have that man to rule over us. And they revolt against him. There's no deceivers. There's nothing bad happening in the world anymore. And they're going to attack Jesus? What's going on, man? Let me submit to you. And you chew on this. I submit to you, the millennial generation, the last generation, it's the 10th generation, that rebels against Christ will be the wickedest generation to ever live on the planet. Why would I say that? Because they're sinning in full knowledge. When you sin, your level of judgment is according to the knowledge you have. To whom much is given, much will be required, right? That principle works. The more you know, the more you will be judged, as far as an unbelieving situation. So people in America who think they're going to heaven, and they're really not, and when there's Bibles everywhere, you can go to Walmart and get a dollar Bible or whatever, churches everywhere, and didn't use that access to know Christ, will have a stricter judgment than someone living in the Amazon who couldn't get a hold of anybody. They still will be judged. But who's going to have the greater judgment? The one who had access to it, who had access to the internet, access to Bibles, access. It all has to do with how much information you know. So guess what? That generation standing for, that sees visibly Jesus ruling and reigning, will be the wickedest generation to ever be on this planet. It's the 10th generation. I'll get into that. You follow me? Okay. All right. Confinement is judgment of the Gentiles. Pastor Phil alluded to that in his scripture today in Isaiah chapter 11. But what will happen during this time, and here it goes back to the idol. Why is it kept up? It's called the sheep and the goat judgment. Matthew talked about this. What is this? Well, tonight, it's very... not complicated, but there's a lot of scriptures that tie into this, but I'll just say this briefly. Those who are alive at the end of the tribulation, Gentiles, the nations will be brought to Jesus in front of him at the Valley of Jehoshaphat and will be judged. Now, in this judgment, this is not the great white throne judgment. This is called the sheep and the goat. This judgment is for who goes into the millennium. Now, obviously, only believers go into the millennium. Only believers do. But this is a judgment on Gentiles. This is not a judgment on the Jews, by the way. You know why? All unbelieving Jews are gone. Because what has he done? He's destroyed them. If you're an unbelieving Jew, you don't make it out. Zechariah 13 says he kills two-thirds of Israel to purge them, to only what he has left is a remnant. So this is not even a judgment of the Jews. The Jews are sat there on the sideline right now. And what's brought before Christ at this point in time is all Gentiles who are alive. And they're going to be judged on which of these Gentiles will be able to go into the millennium and who is not. I guarantee you, you've read this passage that we're going to read. It's Matthew chapter 25. You've read it, but you've never read it in this kind of context. So turn to Matthew 25 real quick for me. Verse 31, 36. You tell me if you haven't heard this before, but remember, keep the context. Y'all there. Now check this out. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and with all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on His throne of His glory. And all the nations, or goyim, or the Gentiles, will be gathered before Him. And He will separate them from one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. He will set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on His left. Then the King will say to those on His right hand, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." Now watch this. You tell me if you haven't read these words before. "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger or take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison come to you?" And the King will answer and say, here's the key right here, guys. "Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." He just introduced to you a third group in here, didn't he? Who is the brethren? "When you did it to my brethren." Now, I'll tell you this. Most preachers don't know the context of this. And they say, well, when you do it to other believers right now, that's how you make this good. Oh, no, no. That's a secondary application. The primary application is there's two groups. He's named sheep on his right, goats on his left, and a third group called my brethren. When he talks to the sheep, saved Gentiles, they say, "When did we do this for you? We never personally did this to you. What are you talking about?" "When you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." Who is he talking to? You want to confirm this? Turn to Micah. I'll confirm to you who the brethren is, okay? Micah chapter 5. Now, you should have read this for Christmas, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. But you didn't know attached to it was a second coming passage. Micah chapter 5, verse 2. You probably got it on a Christmas card. But they didn't give you verse 3. "But you, Bethlehem Ephratah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are of old, from everlasting." Did you get that in a Christmas card? No, you did. You had to, right? "Therefore, he shall give them up until the time that she who is in labor has given birth." This is talking about the tribulation. The remnant of his what?
Brethren.
Bingo. There's your connection. Who's his brethren? The remnant of Israel are called his brethren. Why are they called his brethren? He calls us brothers, spiritual brothers, right? In Hebrews chapter 2, I believe, right? But why does he call Israel his brothers? Because our Messiah is Jewish. The Jews are his biological kindred. Our Messiah is Jewish. So Micah is telling you the remnant is always called his brethren because they're biologically his. Now you couple that with Matthew 25, when he did it to the least of these, the remnant, the brethren, my Jewish brothers and sisters, you did it to me. What does this have to do with, though? the foundation of this judgment is pro-Semitic versus anti-Semitic. When you were good to the Jews, you did it to me. And then he will continue on and say to the goats, when you did bad things to my brethren, you did bad things to me. Okay, encapsulated this is in the tribulation. What is going on? The Jews will face unsurmountable anti-Semitism during the tribulation, not only from the whore of Babylon, but from the Antichrist himself, who will try to wipe all of them off the face of the planet. Unbelievable persecution. What believers, Gentiles, will do during this time, they will see that the Antichrist is bent on destroying the Jews. They will go and try to protect them, much like the Christians did during World War II, hiding Jews from Nazis, right? You studied history. Corrie Ten Boom, right? They were putting Jews in their walls, putting them in their cellars, hiding them. Christians knew better, because Nazis were coming out and taking Jews, putting them in the ghettos, and then eventually to Auschwitz and the gas chambers. Good people like Corrie Ten Boom gave safe harbor to Jews. The same will happen. There will be thousands of Corrie Ten Booms in the tribulation who will take care of the Jews. They see that they're going to get their heads cut off, and they go, and you come stay with me, I'll hide you. Now, what these Gentiles are doing is putting their lives on the line for Jews, because they're going to get their heads cut off if they're caught, and many of them will. They'll lose their lives harboring, keeping the Jews safe from the Antichrist. Many of the Jews will be stuck in Petra. Many of the Jews will be stuck in Jerusalem. Believing Gentiles will come to their aid and help them, and give them water, and give them comfort, and visit them in prison, and all of that. What does that tell you even about right now, even like a personal application of how you should view Israel and Jews? Mm-hmm. If the Lord makes this the basis of His judgment,
still God's people.
They're still God's people, even in unbelief, and you are to tell them the gospel, you are to share Yeshua with them, and you are to support them and not do destructive things to them, because the promise still applies. God's foreign policy on Israel is, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you, whether in belief or unbelief. That still applies. You watch any nation that fools around with Israel, any nation, and watch what God does to them. So in your efforts, even in your personal efforts, always seek to witness to the Jews. Always seek to be supportive of them, because what you'll notice, even right now in our current state of events, people are becoming more anti-Semitic. And by the way, they're going to throw you in there too, because you're a Christian. That's God's people. They don't like that. The world doesn't like that. So all that to say, now what you're saying, wait a second, I don't understand this. You're saying the basis of the judgment is pro-Semitic versus anti-Semitic. Yes. I thought salvation is by grace. Yes. But what is this about? Why doesn't Jesus just say, you guys were saved, you get to go into the kingdom, you weren't, you're going to hell? Why does he make what they did to the Jews what he deals with them on? Do you remember James chapter 2? It says that faith without works is dead. Now, what does that mean? Works don't save you. I obviously know that. Works are a what of your salvation? The byproduct, the fruit, or the evidence of your salvation. There should be evidence when you believe in Yeshua. You have to. You have to be able to produce fruit, otherwise you're stillborn. You should produce fruit. Therefore, when someone says, I believe in Jesus and lives like the devil, I can tell you right now what's going on. They probably didn't get saved. Now, we're not talking about prodigal son living. I'm talking about someone that comes in the aisle, and then the next week they're still doing the same things, and they don't even think back. They don't look back at all at it. What he is basing their judgment on is, he is saying that if you're a believing Gentile, your fruit and evidence that you are saved is that you protect my brethren. The fruit that you're an unbeliever is that you did harm to my brethren. That is the fruit of your salvation. So you don't possess salvation because of how bad you treated the Jews. So I hope you understand that. He is using James chapter 2 as the basis of his judgment. You have to have evidence that you are saved, and the evidence is I will save the Jews at this time, point in time. Clear as mud, right? You all, I hope that makes sense. Micah chapter 5, it's right after the Bethlehem passage. Micah chapter 5, verse 3, that's your connection to my brethren. So then after that, you have the resurrection of the Old Testament saints, Moses, Elijah, Daniel, David, all of them will be resurrected at this time. Again, I don't know the chronological order. Also, the resurrection of the tribulation saints will come. Look in verse 4 of chapter 20 of Revelation. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Oh, by the way, that's us right there. That's the church. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. I'll get into the resurrection, first and second resurrection next week. To say is, and now the tribulation saints who went through the tribulation and died are now resurrected. So both groups are involved in the first resurrection. That's a category. Oh, well, let's do it right now. I didn't know I had it. The resurrection order, when you see in Scripture, it'll talk about the first resurrection and the second resurrection. What we're talking about is categories of resurrection. You definitely want to make sure you're involved in the first resurrection. If you're involved in the second resurrection, that's for the unregenerate. By the way, Paul mentioned in Corinthians, he gave a Greek term, that you will come in military rank or order. There's different resurrections in the first category. The first one is obviously Jesus, right? With him came a wave offering of people came out of the tombs. They went into Jerusalem. The second to last chapter of Matthew talked about that. The church will come, then the two witnesses, and then the Old Testament saints and tribulation saints. Once these are resurrected, that is the last of the first resurrection that will ever occur of believers. There will be no more believers resurrected at that point. That's done. The second resurrection goes all the way. The first one is the Antichrist. Then the last one is at the end of the millennium, and that includes all unrighteous that's ever lived. So those are your categories, first and second resurrections. Marriage Feast of the Lamb happens. It will happen on earth. Old Testament saints are there. Will there? You might be sitting next to Moses, Daniel. I don't know who will be sitting next to you, but we have the Marriage Feast of the Lamb. Application. Tying up loose ends must be done. You cannot delay loose ends. If you notice with Christ, he put an end to it. He only allowed the Antichrist to really run loose for about 3.5 years. Tying up loose ends is not pleasurable. This is why people don't do it. This is why you notice in your family that someone won't confront somebody when they're acting like a knucklehead, because it's not pleasurable to confront somebody. It's hard. Tying up loose ends means you will have to go back to the issue. And people don't want to do this. Let me end on this. And Lord taking Peter back to his issues. You remember Peter denied the Lord 3 times. I want you to read John chapter 20 and John chapter 21 about Peter's reinstatement. You know what he does with Peter? He takes Peter back to the issue. If you'll notice, there's a campfire with coals. If you notice, he takes him and there's a miraculous draft of fish being caught. If you notice, he makes Peter say, I love you, how many times?
3 times.
You tell me all those 3 instances, the miraculous draft of fish that they caught. What does that remind you of? A past instant. The coal of fire that Peter's around, and Jesus is actually cooking a meal in front of the fire, and Peter arrives. And what does the idea of making him say it 3 times, I love you, have to do with going back to the issue? If you want to tie up loose ends in your life, this is the most unpleasurable issue, is having to go back to the main point that you got off. That's the hardest. Because now you have to relive the feelings and emotions and the problems. And God is saying, I need you to deal with this. And you keep running from this and you keep burying it. But I'm trying to bring you back so you can have freedom. That's why he did that to Peter. Check what he did to Peter 3 times. He brought Peter back to the issue 3 times. It's unpleasurable, but tying up loose ends is a blessing to other people. You do this, It'll bless others. Guarantee it. I got to run. I got to do the invitation for Pastor Phil. We'll see you next week as we get into the millennium.